Hello, welcome to another Bruin podcast. This year, 2020, has begun with a dramatic repricing of interest rate expectations in the UK. And so who better to speak to about this than Mike Riddell and Kasper Brzeznek of Allianz Global Investors. And they'll tell us what they think is going on in rates markets in the UK and abroad.
I would say never underestimate the propensity of Germans to save. I know when times are good, they save for the bad times. When times are bad, they save as well.
So hopefully that teaser has sufficiently whetted your appetite. Make sure you stay listening after the following messages.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Bruin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everybody, welcome to another Bruin podcast. We're going to be talking about matters of macroeconomic and market importance with our guests this week, who are Mike Riddell and Kasper Brzeznek, who are the co-managers of the Allianz Strategic Bond Fund. So guys, thanks very much for joining us. I think if we just sort of start with a very high level outlook, you know, we certainly feel like after what was quite a downbeat year for growth in many sectors and many parts of the world, there's some signs really that things are looking to improve a bit as we go into 2020. I guess, you know, always slightly worrying that we see a fair few other people who now seem to have that view as well. Are you going to go out on a limb with some dramatically different outlook, or are you hugging the consensus with us?
Well, the short answer is we're hugging the consensus with you. The slightly longer answer is that different markets price in very different things.
Right.
And if you look at credit markets, if you look at credit spreads, or if you look at equities, or you can look at currencies, you know, implied volatility, or really any cross, even sterling crosses, you know, euro sterling is pricing in the least volatility than it has since 2007. So there's nothing priced into markets at all, except for government bonds, which are clearly still pricing in the risk of a slowdown. So given that our view is, yes, and we share it, that data has been improving materially, I guess maybe to recap, 2018 was a really bad year. Beginning of 2019, we were seeing signs of improvement. Those signs, or the green shoots, withered and died in April, May. Then in September of 2019, we started seeing signs again of an improvement. If you look at things like money supply growth in really every area. And then with a bit of a lag, and these are lead indicators for us, we have started seeing a real improvement in the actual data. Led by actually the Eurozone this time, unusually. It tends to actually lag, but it's led it. In November, we saw a material improvement in Eurozone economic data. The US followed a few weeks later.
What kind of things are looking at in the Eurozone?
Actually, almost everything. I mean, manufacturing clearly has lagged a bit, and that's linked to global manufacturing cycle, trade wars not helping. But if you look at PMIs, if you look at services, you look at business confidence, and you're seeing improvements. And we have a team based in Frankfurt, the economics and strategy team, they have people around the world. They have one measure, which is called the macro breadth index, which is an indicator of over 300 macro variables. And it's to get a gauge of the global economy and what's improving. And in December, almost everything improved. So it's one of the biggest increases or improvements that we've seen for the last 8 or 9 years, happened in December of 2019. So our indicators, such as money supply growth, are suggesting that this, to mix metaphors, these green shoots do have legs. You know, we are expecting data to continue improving over the next 3 to 6 months. Data has been improving already. Equity markets, you can argue, are pricing a lot of this in already because, you know, there's a lot of, you know, the valuations
it was
a
great year last year.
Great year last year and a great start this year. Bond markets, like I say, are different though. And this is where from really being, I'd say, for the last few years, we've had a bit of a bias to be long duration. We tend to think that the global economy is weakening. Bond markets were still thinking about rate hikes. Mm. Now the global economy is recovering. Bond markets are thinking about rate cuts. So that's where I think the dislocation might be a little bit. We've just in the last few weeks been moving actually shorter duration, and actually in some funds quite aggressively short duration. We think that government bond markets in the UK, for example, there's almost a cut this month fully priced in. And if it's not going to happen this month, the market thinks it will definitely happen in March.
Yeah.
We are of a view that actually there's a chance they wait, because data in the UK hasn't really yet improved much, but usually what happens is it moves with the rest of the world and we should see signs of improvement.
Okay. Well, let's go there then, because as you say, the UK data is probably one area where we're not seeing much of an improvement, or I guess it's a mixed picture. I mean, things like the house price data was looking a bit stronger, and normally that's quite a good proxy for what's going on in the UK. But what are the things that are driving the MPC's decision, or what are the things that are going to determine for them whether they do or don't cut at the end of this month?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I think with the UK is that a lot of people's views on the UK economy match their outlook on Brexit, to be perfectly honest. And so you have to adjust a little bit for that. But I think where the dynamic we're at the moment is we've moved from an election and the sort of possibility of no deal Brexit to actually looking at the merits of the deal itself and the implications on the economy of that. I think, the Bank of England turned a bit dovish at the end of last year when the details were being ironed out. I suspect their opinion of it is probably not that positive, and I suspect the market is similar in that, and that's why sterling quickly sold off post-election, and that's why the market has also been quite dovish. But I think the problem is it's very early. UK data has been quite weak in many areas, but it's pretty early. And normally, as Mike said, the UK would move with the rest of the world. But also, post-election, whether it's the UK, Sweden or Brazil, normally you get quite a bit of positivity just from getting through it. And I think the fact that for most market participants, for most businesses, the outcome was not just getting rid of a bit of uncertainty, it was definitely positive, I think, for a lot of people. It may well be that we will see some uptick in UK data. We get PMIs.
So you mean a lot of businesses?
For a lot of businesses.
Concerns about a very left-wing government.
Exactly. I mean, if you look at businesses, they undoubtedly, generally speaking, support a conservative government. And I think in this case, it was even more extreme. There are signs, as you said, that some data has got better, house prices. It may be that business confidence has actually increased quite a lot. It's very, very soon after the election to say we get the PMIs quite soon ahead of the head of the Bank of England decision. I suspect if the data come in quite strong, which is very possible, the Bank of England could wait. The market might be surprised by that, but it would certainly make sense.
And so what wouldn't the Bank of England have liked about this deal? Is it the prospect of having to rush a free trade agreement and therefore potentially not being able to reach one? Is that the biggest issue here?
I think that's always plays a part, but if you look at Bank of England, they've always said that their assumption is whatever the government tells them to. So they never assumed we're going to get no deal. They always kind of look at sort of average of outcomes. But if the government says these are our intentions, the Bank of England has sort of broadly based their models of that as sort of the medium outcome. And the government is now saying, we want this deal. But I think it's a very narrow deal, a sort of Canada-style deal. I think most economists from any side of the debate, from various different places, would suggest, and including the government's own models, have suggested that this is a negative outcome. And I think if you go back a few years, what we're aiming for now, and this is the government is aiming for, is would have been called hard Brexit back in the day. I think that's where we're at now. Look, that said, I think the easiest thing to do would be to wait to see, because one of the things that we've seen is business investment has been weak in the UK. I think that's been a specific driver of weakness in the UK. And we've had this sort of idea about cash being on the sidelines. And once we get some certainty, businesses can start to invest again. Again, I'm not sure whether...
So when will we get the certainty that businesses require in order to invest again?
Well, I don't know, but I think in the next few months, we should certainly see whether there's been any uptick. We can see that through data. Right. We can see that through...
There we will be able to see whether the election itself was enough to provide that uplift.
And PMIs themselves. I mean, that PMIs, Purchasing Manager Index, as you call it, which is the most, I guess, widely used measure of business confidence, and it does tend to lead slightly economic growth. So if businesses say, now we're really confident in the outlook, then they will start investing. So that's the first signal, and we'll get that for the UK, signs of a rebound maybe next week.
Okay, but it may be that business feels positively about the election result, but is still sufficiently uncertain about trading arrangements with the EU, and that's just something we're going to have to wait and see.
Base case is UK growth is not going to be phenomenal for the next few years. I'm not sure it's going to be phenomenal anywhere, to be perfectly honest, but I'm skeptical that businesses are now, you know, uncertainty is finished, they're all going to rush and start building factories, and foreign firms who talked about ending car manufacturing in, you know, Northern England are suddenly going to say, actually, we think it's a great idea now. No, that's, I think, gone. You're not going to get that back. And then there's the trade deal itself. Maybe there is a chance that we have a free trade deal arranged with the EU this year, but I'd say it's exceptionally unlikely.
Yeah.
So that uncertainty, I think, will continue.
So the UK leaves at the end of this month, on 31st of this month, and then there is a relatively short window before they have to effectively ask for an extension. And most commentators, I don't know if you agree with this, most commentators would say if they haven't asked for an extension by June, then it makes a WTO terms Brexit look more likely. If that's true, that could be quite a traumatic time, I guess, for UK financial markets.
We're not going to have any clarity about that for a few months. But I think, from the end of Q2, people are going to start focusing on that. And
I think that the no deal rhetoric will definitely be ramped up and markets will get concerned about it. In the end of it, we can take 100 commentators. None of them will know. We don't know what will happen. My guess is that while we will ramp up the rhetoric, we will avoid a no deal. And I mean, if you see Boris Johnson's style on this before, you know, we ramped up no deal rhetoric. In the end, he ended up accepting what was the EU's kind of original deal to Theresa May, which she rejected, and kind of got this, whatever you want to call it, a border in the Irish Sea. I think the main objectives here seem to be to get anything done. But to avoid no deal, I think it's clear that they want to avoid no deal despite what they say. I think they want to get anything done. And as I said, their ambitions aren't very big here. They're not aiming for the world's most comprehensive trade deals. They're going for something bare bones. And I think in the end, the UK government will agree to kind of whatever's on the table, because they're not even asking for that for anything too complicated.
Well, I mean, it's an astute observation you make there then, that I mean, this is what we've seen obviously before, lots of tough talk and then ultimately a degree of acquiescence to whatever ends up being on the table. So as investors, does that give you an idea about what your strategy is throughout these things? Is it basically, you know, fade the tough talk?
Yeah, fade really. Any move in either direction is generally being
our game plan. Right, there has been to fade extremes, and actually we've seen very little except for the election night where you saw sterling versus dollar at 135, very quickly back to 130. I think we'd fade either extreme at the moment, and we always like to remind people that as much as UK domestic politics and economics comes into play, you know, if you look at gilts, I think as Mike was saying earlier, last year the correlation between gilts and US Treasuries is something like 0.9, and it's always those two markets are always going to be correlated. I think it's surprising probably to most people that last year we were at the upper end of that correlation. So I think
so you mean with a very big UK story going on, actually gilts were trading like treasuries, yeah, and other global bonds.
Exactly. And I think they always do. It's the degree to which changes, but we've got to, you know, we've got to look at the broader economy really to see, to kind of make key decisions really.
And that's why when we're managing, you know, whether it's our gilt fund, which is over 2 billion, whether it's like strategic bond fund or any of the other funds we manage, we manage these on the global macro top-down basis. Even the gilt fund, which you might think, as Kath mentioned, that it's all driven by Brexit or no-deal Brexit fears, but it's global macro and really what the Fed and the ECB do is the most important thing.
Okay. Well, that said, let's carry on talking about what the FDIC do. Now, I mean, to give you a very difficult question, we've got a new governor coming into to the Bank of England. Do we know anything about what that might mean? This is Andrew Bailey, of course, coming from the FCA. Do we know anything about what that might mean for monetary policy?
No, we don't have much insight into what Andrew Bailey's macro thoughts are at the moment. If you look at the MPC, the last few meetings, you've had two people of the nine vote for a rate cut. In the last few weeks, we've had seemingly coordinated messaging from other members of the MPC saying if we don't see a meaningful rebound in UK data, really in the next few weeks, and particularly the PMI data that's coming quite soon, then they would also vote for a rate cut. So this is what's really moved market expectations.
And you say seemingly coordinated. Does it feel like there's almost a different communication strategy that this message? I mean, it's taken what, just under 2 weeks or something to really get that message into the market, and it kind of came a little bit from nowhere in terms of rate expectations. So does it look like they're trying to do something different in terms of getting that expectation out?
Or if they think there's a risk they're going to cut and they think the market's not pricing it in, then they'll try and steer the market a little bit. Yeah. As I say, you did have two people of the nine vote for a cut last year, so it's not completely out of the blue. And you only need three more for it to actually happen.
But often you've got some kind of perma-doves and some perma-hawks, and all that really matters is what Mark Carney's going to do or something like that in the middle. So, having two voting for a cut doesn't necessarily mean there's a sort of growing consensus, whereas this communication really suggests that there is, as you put it, a material risk, I guess.
Yeah, and I think the issue for us now is that we did think that it was more likely that the UK would be cutting than hiking last year, but we didn't think it was going to happen imminently. Clearly, given the communication, there is now a good chance of it happening imminently. But then the point is, what's market pricing in? At one point last week, it's come back a little bit. It's pricing in 70% chance of a cut this month, fully pricing in a cut this year, and actually pricing in slightly more than a cut.
Yeah.
So the market's already thinking, well, if it's not a cut in January, it's going to be a cut in March. And assuming there's then a cut, there's then a chance of another cut later this year.
Yeah.
So the market is thinking that actually UK rates could well be below 0.5, might even be a quarter of a percent back to where they were after the referendum in 2016.
It's always a difficult discussion when it comes to central banks. People get very passionate about what the central bank should do. Our focus has to be on what the central bank will do. But in terms of what it should do, I mean, I would personally wait. January seems so early, following the election, following a withdrawal agreement being passed, to take action. And I think one of the things the Bank of England will have to consider is the idea that they cut now and then they have to hike in the future to reverse that. So I think it's not a done deal at all. I really do think if we do get these PMIs coming stronger, we'll start going below 50%, at least for January.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, we've obviously got a fiscal event coming up in March as well. We thought we'd seen the back of spring budgets, but they're back again. And new chancellor and a whole new Conservative Party are trying to appeal to new voters with some sort of semblance of a new ideology. So, has this got the potential to be a more important budget than ones we've seen before? Which I think you've commented on before, like they actually don't typically move the market as much as you might expect.
I think the market is expecting something because it's been signalled. I mean, think about the discussion going into the general election at the end of last year was people were trying to outdo each other and who could spend the most money. And when they weren't talking about that, they're talking about who could plant the most trees and other silly things that you get before general elections.
Kiss the most babies.
Kiss the most babies, exactly. So, clearly there's a demand for more fiscal stimulus. And that fiscal stimulus, or any kind of stimulus, is kind of warranted. If you look at just the simple facts of where the UK economy is right now, well, Q4 growth was close to zero, and currently UK inflation is at 1.3. So based on that, then maybe interest rate cuts and fiscal stimulus or some kind of stimulus make sense. UK fiscal stimulus, I think, is going to come back. I think really regardless of the Tory success in the north of England, that's been a signal for a while.
But if that signalled, does that then underline your point? The point you made before, that actually the budget doesn't tend to move stuff because people, you know, there's going to be some spending. People expect there to be some spending. So, like, the market's not going to care about that. Or is there potential for them, you know, do you think there's a material risk that actually they change their fiscal rules or, you know, even from what they've changed them to or spend more or in a different way or something like that?
I think, given it's expected markets are going to be pricing in, have priced it in to a certain extent, I don't think it's going to move the needle. I suspect that where you'll see significant increases in fiscal spending would be if the economy continued to go weaker. You got to remember, this is the government, you know, of Brexit. We are just in the middle of leaving the European Union. And I think it's in the particular interest of this government to make the economy as good as possible. I suspect that in base case, you don't see anything that will move the needle past, you know, more than expectations. But I think where you will see something significant is if the economy is turning lower and you're maybe getting some negative headlines, maybe a car manufacturer decides to move. And that's where I think the government can and will borrow significantly more. And let's, you know, I think the Chancellor this weekend mentioned the low level of interest rates. All around the world, we've got, you know, incredibly low level of interest rates and no one seems to be taking advantage of it. There is scope, there is room to take advantage of it. And people always have these debates about level of debt. I mean, the reality is the UK could borrow a lot more. It wouldn't be a problem.
Willingness and ability is always different. And I think there's a lot of expectation, actually, that Germany is going to do lots of fiscal stimulus. The ECB has been saying this for ages, is that we've run out of ammunition. It's now up to you to do some stimulus and reform, which reform never really happens. But I would say never underestimate the propensity of Germans to save. I know when times are good, they save for the bad times. And when times are bad, they save as well. So it's whatever happens, you know. It is just not in the psyche to borrow lots and spend.
Even with the prospect of a coalition government involving the Green Party?
Then you could get a little bit. But I think to really drive Eurozone growth stronger, you need more than just a little bit of stimulus in Germany. Yeah. You need a lot of stimulus in Germany, and that's going to be difficult.
I think, going on to Germany, we were just in a meeting and we were talking about this, and you know, when growth was weaker in Germany, there was a lot more talk about stimulus. Now, data's picking up a little bit, growth has picked up a little bit, and the natural thing to do is, actually, everything is fine. And that's what we heard at the weekend from the Economic Council. Well, things maybe aren't that bad, but we don't need to. So really, for fiscal stimulus, both in Germany and the UK, maybe you need things to get a little bit worse, and then that will encourage the governments to actually... to actually borrow and spend more.
Okay, well, so looking globally, obviously one of the major stories has been the trade war. You'd see the easing of that as being a sort of material factor in sort of driving better economic data, or do you think we were just kind of on that glide path anyway?
General view, and no one has, I don't know how many times now, it's 15 or 16, the market's got very excited there's going to be a trade deal announced, and then it's been... it hasn't occurred. My view all along is that this is ultimately just a political game. The things that have been discussed doesn't make a material difference to the US economy. And if China buys a few billion of agriculture from the US, it doesn't actually matter. It's just to appeal to voters. And I think this is ahead of the presidential election, then maybe something more material will be magically pulled out of the hat. And it's just
Do you think last year's manufacturing slowdown was materially driven by the trade war?
No, I don't. And this is, I think the consensus was that the trade war was the most important thing and drove everything. There's no doubt that the trade war damaged Chinese growth a bit and Asian growth more broadly. I don't think it really drove US growth that much. I think, generally speaking, the slowdown that we saw in the first half of 2019, but in particular 2018, was down to the old classic yield curve. You know, the yield curve in the US was very flat and then inverted. What flat yield curves mean is that banks don't want to borrow and lend. Because if you're borrowing at 2%, you're not going to lend at 1.5% because you lose money. So this is what always happens in economic cycles. So the slowdown we saw, I think, was a function of the Fed trying to hike rates aggressively and then the market effectively telling them you can't hike anymore and you've hiked too much, actually.
I think if you look at it, 2018, obviously we had last quarter equities went down. But if you look at 2018, it's worth remembering that data was getting weak all year. And I remember we were sat there somewhere at the beginning, in the middle of the year, and we looked at countries that had negative GDP, and we had Switzerland, Sweden, Japan. This was broad based. And people were still blaming on the trade war or saying everything was fine. We had a broad based slowdown for many reasons, and I think the trade war contributed in the end, but it wasn't a key factor. Going back to something I think you said at the very beginning, in terms of kind of consensus for growth this year, I think there's two key challenges. One of them is that, unlike at the beginning of last year, where we had a big risky market drawdown, equities fell, credit spreads widened. We're coming into the beginning of this year. Yes, data's getting better, but markets have, some markets, especially, I'd say, risky asset classes, have priced a lot of the good news in. So that's one of the key challenges, is even if data gets better, actually, what are returns going to be like for equities? Are we going to get, a year like last year? Probably not. But the second challenge is, and we're seeing this already this year, is there's, a lot of different things happen, whether it's political, geopolitical, now we've got the virus. So, wherever you're, for example, for a short duration position, data's getting better. But, first, you have the Iran situation. Now you're getting norovirus. You're getting a lot of these
not
different...
norovirus. That would be markets.
Well, we definitely had
to... Casper, have you got the norovirus? I'm so sorry. You've taken your time out to do this podcast. Yeah. Extremely generous of you.
It does need a better name, though. Coronavirus.
Yeah, coronavirus.
It's got the novel virus.
The novel, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's
a key challenge. It's an inspiring name, isn't it? Yeah.
And, I think that's given positioning, these sort of events are going to be tougher than normal, because people are already very long equities, people are already long credit. So you get these different events that can come out of nowhere, and people take their positions off, etc. So that's a key challenge for this year that we'll have to navigate. But ultimately, I think, as with Iran, we had a lot of people who became Iranian political experts. We're going to get some biological disease experts coming out in the next few weeks. I suspect in a few months' time, we won't be talking about Iran or coronavirus anymore, but there'll be something else, I'm sure.
So, it's kept bonds pretty well bid, though, hasn't it? So is this something that, again, would feed into that sort of fade the story category?
Yeah, in our view, it is, exactly. It's the bond rally we've seen this year. If you think about, US Treasuries, actually, 10-year Treasuries rallied 15 bips, 20 basis points. Quite a big material rally in the first week of January, and that's on the Iran fears. And it seems that no one's talking about Iran anymore, but yields are still where they were. So they haven't rebounded back to where they were at the beginning of the year. And I think this is just another reason for bonds to have a bit of a rally on fear and concerns of something spreading in Asia and going outside of Asia. But I doubt very much it's going to be killing loads and loads of people, and it seems to be not as bad as SARS, but that's just preliminary observation.
No, I'd agree with that. And obviously, from a market perspective, you had MERS and swine flu and SARS, and they all, I guess for reasons other than the pathogen, they all took place in environments of extremely strong equity markets, and I guess probably not particularly strong bond markets, but that's just kind of what was going on at the time.
Yeah, we looked at on SARS. I mean, Hong Kong equities did underperform by around 15% in kind of the beginning of 2003, but couldn't really see much movement in other markets.
No, so you're kind of recovering from a 2002 collapse at the time.
At the moment, we're seeing people, Australian dollars being impacted by this. Again, Australian dollars has a link to China, but I think it's a bit far-fetched for now.
So if bonds are very pretty richly priced, I guess it's kind of how we began this discussion. Equities have had such a strong year last year that they need really some pretty good news just to justify where they got to. And what does that leave you with options? What do you do with the fund in order to preserve or make wealth in 2020?
It's a big challenge. I'd say the biggest macro conviction view we have is that I mean, no one's really used the word Goldilocks again, because whenever they use the word Goldilocks, then they get egg on face very quickly. But I'm sure people will start talking about the Goldilocks economy again, where growth is, you know, it's not too hot, it's just right. You know, we're not in recession, things are okay. There's no inflation. You know, central banks can ride to the rescue at the slightest sign of problems.
That ended up being 2019 story, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I think that's still the story now. In fact, it's even more extreme, if anything. And the macro perspective, as we've mentioned, actually data is recovering. It looks okay. We're not seeing signs of inflation. So I don't disagree with the narrative. But at some point in the next few years, something is going to happen. And it might be a recession or it might be something else. So the macro view that we have is just that there will be a return to volatility. And we can take those views, actually using derivatives and options, you know, where we pay a small amount away. And if there's a movement in, say, currencies, then we can make quite a lot of money on the upside. And you can actually really insure your portfolios and not having to take directional views, just taking a view that something is going to happen.
Right.
And that's where...
The volatility is unusually low now.
Incredibly.
So you can kind of
exactly
see where it's likely to go.
Exactly. And things like credit spreads, which tend to, the extra yield in a corporate bond over a government bond, highly correlated to something like the VIX or you know, any other source of volatility in any financial market. Credit spreads right now in the Eurozone are around the tightest in 12 years. You know, it's pricing in no risk of recession. Well, in the next 3 years, what's the chance of recession? I don't know, 40%, 50%. So I don't think it's going to happen imminently, but if it doesn't happen in the next 6 months, well, yields are so low, you're not losing much and, you know, in having loads of high yielding, high risk bonds in your portfolio. So we're happy to wait. If you wait, you're not losing much in carry or yield. And then we'll step in when things are more attractive. But I think at the moment, it is a challenge. Risky assets are very expensive and risk-free assets are pretty expensive.
We were having a joke at the desk the other day because I was having a scan of the world to look for, you know, anything interesting that actually has a yield. And looking far and wide, you know, it is amazing how tight spreads are, especially in the short-dated world. You know, that's been a favorite of the market. Mm. Anything short-dated high yield, short-dated emerging markets, etc., you're really not getting compensated, as I said, not even for any sort of default risk, but even liquidity risk if you ever have to sell your position. You know.
And that's a reflection of people being pushed into that part of the market who would otherwise normally invest somewhere a bit safer, I guess.
Exactly. And I think that's, you know, I guess that's the intention of negative rates,
yeah.
If you will. I think it's just so dangerous to chase that. Right now, and you know, maybe as we said, you know, our base case is, you know, things getting a little bit better, maybe nothing goes wrong, but I think that, you know, the amount of extra yield you're picking up, I don't think it's very prudent to be piling in there.
Okay, well, brilliant. That's a sort of patient note then to end the podcast on. Casper, Mike, thanks so much for joining us and giving us that rundown on what's going on around the world and in the UK. And thanks to all our listeners for tuning in. We hope you'll be able to join us again soon for another Bruin podcast.